This is the Voice of America, Studio One. Alaska, the Last Frontier. A program commemorating the 100th anniversary of the Alaska Purchase by the United States. Today, a portrait of the people of Alaska. The second of a series of programs on the history, the people, the legend, and the promise of the 49th state. Here is Rhett Turner.
Throughout the story of mankind, civilizations have risen and flourished in the temperate zones of the earth, where warmth, sunshine, water, and arable land fostered the growth of population. But there have been extremes in the great northern land masses of the earth, extremes which reach beyond the limits of most human environment into winters of perpetual cold and brief dry summers of sweltering heat. Here, life has survived only by strength and endurance. Plants, animals, and men have undergone nature's cruelest test, and only the fittest have survived. So it's not surprising to go into the American North and find a different breed of men and their women. It's not surprising to find some of the largest and strongest of game animals here, or some of the Earth's best untapped natural resources. Among the most unusual of men to live and survive in the Arctic, the Alaskan Eskimo.
What food they had were fish from the lake.
Tom Brower, an Eskimo I visited and talked with in Barrow.
They had all types of fish, and then they had the seals, like the bearded seal and the smaller seal. Mm-hmm. And then they even had the eider ducks. The whole Arctic North will be teeming with bird life during the nesting seasons, but the eider duck was their main source in the bird life.
And the Eskimo hunted walrus, seal, and caribou, and caught the great bowhead whale. It was a harsh life, a life of bare survival. I asked Tom Brower if there was any other type of food on the Arctic coast other than from animals, birds, and fish.
Up about, say, 30 miles from the coast, there is what we call sweet grass, and it's more like what we'd call lettuce. It's a long grass, and the native people use that as a kind of a vegetable, and they would pick salmon berries and blueberries, I would say, about 60 miles in from the coast on the tundra country.
For 10,000 years, the Eskimo has lived in this land of ice, snow, and tundra, the land of endless day and endless night. To survive, he hunted. Eskimo Pete Sovalik lived this way.
Inland people, where I was raised, we used a shot house frame with a willow frame. Wintertime, we always move. Our people moving all the time, follow the caribou.
They lived in sod houses built on slender willow frames. In the winter, they moved, living in hastily built ice houses or igloos, following the wild caribou herds. They trapped foxes for their fur, hunted caribou for the meat and skin. In the summer, the Eskimo built skin boats and hunted and fished along the rivers. Again, Pete Sovalik.
In summertime, move a pit to, quite a bit, I mean, mm-hmm. by the rivers with boat, otherwise by foot, carrying the stuff with dogs, something like that, with backpack, you know.
Mm-hmm. What kind of boats did you build?
Canoe, skin boat.
Eskimos are among the happiest and friendliest people on Earth. It may be a measure of their hardship that makes them respond with enthusiastic warmth to visitors in their great land. Dr. Max Brewer, director of the Arctic Research Laboratory at Point Barrow, gave me this explanation.
Up here, an unhappy person wouldn't survive very long. And they are also very practical, because the person up here that is not practical also will not survive very long, or certainly not stay very long.
For 17 years, Dr. Brewer has been at the Arctic Research Laboratory, operated by the Navy Department and the University of Alaska. He has lived closely with Eskimos all this time and believes that one of the reasons for the outgoing, friendly personality of the Eskimo is because of traditional dependence on his companions, his realization that he must live and work with others to survive. Again, Dr. Brewer.
The Eskimos have unusual talents. They are slow, however, to foist these talents on us. Therefore, they have one word that is extremely important. It is the word maybe. It can mean either yes, no, or maybe. For instance, if you ask an Eskimo to do something that is foolish, he will suggest that maybe some alternative approach is desirable, or that maybe the weather might not be so good. The alternative approach is one that gives you a chance to realize that you have made a mistake, to change. As a result, if it does not come off as you had planned, he has not lost face for letting you down. You have not lost face for not accomplishing the work.
Traditional Eskimo life is now rapidly changing as modern communication and transportation bring the outside world closer to the Arctic. Eben Hobson is one of the leading citizens in the town of Barrow. This little Arctic coast center now has some 2,000 of the 28,000 Eskimos in Alaska. Hobson, who was born in Barrow, has served in the state legislature and is now president of the Barrow City Council. He described to me how life has changed for the Eskimo from a nomadic existence to settled life in the village.
Even with the pressures of perhaps what you might call struggles for survival as far as hunting for food is concerned, they've begun to realize that sooner or later they're going to give their children an opportunity to go to school. So Barrow, along the Arctic coast, was the only place that had a school besides Wainwright, which is 100 miles southwest of here, also along the Arctic coast. But people traveled with dog team and ended up in Barrow and started living here. And the reason moving into Barrow has been a want for education for the children. And I think it probably started in the late 1930s.
One of Eben Hobson's sons, Charles, is 23 years old. He went to a primary school in Barrow and then to a high school for Indian and Eskimo children provided in southern Alaska. Charles explains how the Bureau of Indian Affairs of the U.S. government may provide college education for young Alaskan natives if they desire it.
BIA's got this grant, you know, for natives from Alaska, and they send them to university if they don't have no money and they want to go to school. So BIA just puts them right through college if they want to, through a grant that pays for everything.
Charles Hobson plans to go to college under this grant system within the next few years. At the moment, he's a field assistant at the Arctic Research Laboratory. He and others like him guide and assist scientists who come to the laboratory to conduct research out in the Arctic wastes. Without the Eskimo assistant, wise in the ways of the cold, many of these scientists would perish. And the laboratory has brought jobs and wages to an Eskimo population that no longer wanders the ice and tundra. When the Russians discovered Alaska in 1741 and fur traders established colonies here, Alaska, the great land, was open to the world for the first time. After the United States purchased the territory in 1867, almost all of the Russians left, though today the influence of the Russian Orthodox Church is still felt in places where colonies were established, particularly in Kodiak and Sitka. Those are the bells of St. Michael's Russian Orthodox Church in Sitka. And that is the choir of St. Michael's Church. Most members of the church are native Tlingit Indians who were converted by Russian Orthodox priests who maintain the church today. Two major Indian nations are native to Alaska. The inland Athabascans, who range the interior country of the Tanana and Yukon River areas, and the Tlingits of southeastern Alaska. Today, there are about 14,000 Indians among Alaska's 270,000 people. They have gradually been assimilated into the rest of the population in the frontier state. A specialist in Indian lore and art is Carl Heinmiller of Port Chilkoot on the southeast coast.
Well, the Tlingit Nation, which is of the northwest coast, range from Ketchikan to Skagway, which is north of us about 15 miles, and as far west as Yakutat, which is about 150 miles. And this is in the southeastern section of Alaska, which is the panhandle, all coastal, and the majority of the villages, which number about 17, are all mostly on islands. And these people possibly came over from Asia about 1500 BC, landed around Wrangell and lived there till, we would guess it of 600 years ago, when they gravitated from there into as far north as where we are here and as far south as Ketchikan.
Apparently, these natives migrated by boat from Asia.
Of course, in the early days, their culture was based on the richness of the area of in vegetation and the fish in the sea. And this, of course, was their reason for their high art culture.
The Tlingits were a comparatively rich and comfortable Indian nation, and their great carved totems are monuments to their artistic culture. Farther to the north and inland was the Athabascan Indian nation.
From north of us up to the Arctic Circle are the Athabascan Indians, which number, say, 10,000, and they are understood to come over when the land bridge connected with Asia and Alaska some 5,000 BC, and they are, of course, connected with the Apache and the Navajo, having come over and gone down the Rocky Mountain Trench and well into Mexico. But these people have, of course, had the same problems that the Tlingit people have of dying off from the white man's disease, although their art form was not like the Tlingit, mainly because they had to work pretty hard to keep alive.
In 1880, Joe Juneau discovered gold near the capital city, which now bears his name. Alaska's 40-mile river had its big gold strike in 1886, and there were others. Back in the lower 48, as Alaskans refer to the area to the south, a long economic depression had begun. And when word came that a ton of gold had arrived from the Klondike River in the Canadian Yukon, conditions were just right for the Great Stampede. In 1898, over 40,000 gold prospectors tramped across the passes from Alaska into the Yukon, most of them through ice and snow and temperatures 30 to 50 degrees below zero. Frank Young was a boy 6 years old at the time. His father took him across Chilkoot Pass on his back.
Well, we climbed the pass, which was pretty steep in places. What I can remember of it, at that time when I was a child, after we got over the pass, we got into the lakes there, and then through the lakes and on to Whitehorse and on down the Yukon to Dawson. My dad packed me most of the way. When the going got real tough for me, I was just a youngster, and I remember my dad packing me part of the way over that pass. My father was a man, probably weighs 185 or 90, physically fit. Mm-hmm. He was a man in them days of about probably 25 years old.
Another man who was there when the gold rush started is Bobby Sheldon, and his father before him, who had followed the California gold rush in 1849.
In the late 50s, he heard that there was a gold stampede or gold strike up in Canada known as the Cassiar Country. And he went on a sailing ship up to what was then the little town of Wrangell and up the Stikine River to what is what was known as the Kaziar country, and he didn't seem to find any gold there either, but he had become a pretty good camp cook from his frontier work, so he started a roadhouse and a sort of a trading post of a type, and he became a partner of one of Alaska's famous pioneers known as Jack McQuiston. And they operated together there for years. And because my father had worked at survey work of different types, he did work for the Canadian government in their road building programs there.
In the 1860s, Bob Sheldon's father went back to New York, met and married his wife, and returned to the West. Of eight children, two are still living today. Bob Sheldon, 84 years old, lives in Fairbanks. As a boy of 14, Bobby headed for the Yukon with his father in search of gold. The father, by then a man of 70, didn't make it. He had a heart attack and died, leaving Bobby an orphan in Skagway.
So I started to sell newspapers, and I made it a point to go to all the leading gamblers first, because they had the loose money, and they were all anxious to know what was going on out in the States, because that was the only communication we had with the States, was the newspapers when the boat got in.
Skagway was not only the gateway through which the gold stampeders passed into the Yukon and Alaska, but it quickly became a frontier den of gamblers and thieves preying on the unsuspecting tenderfoot or chechako. Sheldon never became a gold prospector, but learned mechanics and became a marine engineer in Skagway. Having never seen an automobile, he built the first car in Alaska by installing a marine engine in a two-horse carriage. Frank Young, on the other hand, stayed in the gold mining country with his parents after they came across Chilkoot Pass in 1898. For almost 50 of his 75 years, he prospected and hunted throughout inland Alaska. And many the time, Young carried his sourdough pail from camp to camp. It was from this traditional method of making bread in a bucket that the gold miners got the nickname sourdough. I met Frank Young in Fairbanks, where he lives today, and asked him what sort of people came into this rugged country in the first place.
Well, they came from all over the country. What I mean by that, they come from different countries besides the United States, and they were all young men. The biggest part of them were all right in the prime. And they had determination, and that's what it takes. They were loners, all right, but still they liked to get into civilization once in a while, take in the dance halls and see the girls and what have you, because that's the ways of life. You can't beat that, you see.
And they did come from all over, particularly from Ireland and the Scandinavian countries. Gold was discovered all the way from Dawson to Nome on Alaska's west coast.
My father came from Dawson, right behind the breakup, came down the Yukon, about the beginning of June, I would say, in 1900.
Maurice Kelleher, of Irish descent, who has been in Nome most all his life.
He had been in Dawson since 97. Came with a group of Australians to Dawson. He had gone to Australia with his older brothers as a very young boy of 13 or 14, I believe, and eventually ended up in the goldfields, Coolgardie, Western Australia. When Dawson was struck, a lot of Australians took off. In fact, they had a whole boat, and they came on up through the Fiji Islands and on up to Seattle and Vancouver, and then up to Skagway and over to Chilkoot, and it must have been in February or something in 97.
A Dutchman, Gerrit Snyder, came to dig for gold.
Well, I came into Alaska in 1909. I was a steward on the Alaska steamboat, Dolphin, and with a bunch of other prospectors, we floated down the Yukon River, and the first winter, I prospected at Thistle Creek by digging a hole down the frozen ground in order to find the gold nuggets.
And later, this Swede, Herb Engström, a former mechanic.
I come here in 1933, and I've been here now for these years. So we come into the machine age, you see, and come in more like that, using hydraulic, see, and water. Then it comes to the tractor time, when we use tractors. And after that, we come in, so we use a dredge. That's how we mine now. We mine with a dredge.
As a mechanic, Engstrom fitted in with the machine age of gold mining. His claim is 15 miles up the river from Nome. These are a few of the people who came to Alaska when gold fever struck at the turn of the century. They are typical of Alaska's pioneers, who with their descendants are now the backbone of the 49th state. Frank Young is now a retired engineering manager. Bobby Sheldon is one of the directors of a banking institution in Fairbanks. Garrett Snyder became a politician, writer, humorist, and storyteller. Maurice Kelleher is the district judge in Nome. And Herb Engstrom is still mining gold. And there are many more like them. For 10,000 years, men had moved about in Alaska by dog sled, by boat, or on foot. After the big gold stampede into the Klondike, the first railroad bed was hacked out of the rock of White Pass from Skagway to Whitehorse. Later, the government completed a railroad from Seward to Fairbanks. But Alaska remained the great land, the foreboding, trackless land, until another era began in the 1920s. That's when a new invention called the airplane opened up the wilderness. And the age of the bush pilot began.
The year I was born, the weather was so darn bad that year that not a single airplane was able to take to the air. In fact, they were all grounded until the next year, 1903.
One of Alaska's best-known pioneer bush pilots, Bob Reeve. The Wright brothers, of course, made the first powered airplane flight in 1903. Owen Meals of Valdez was one of the early pilots in Alaska. His father came to look for gold and brought young Owen and the rest of the family. Owen used flying as a method of helping to sell Model T Ford automobiles, and then began to fly prospectors and machinery into the snow and ice-filled mountains for gold mining.
Well, we had lots of mining interests that were anxious to get going, and that was a good way of getting service to them. We weren't able to carry it through, but when Bob Reeve came along later on, well, he had a little more nerve than some of the rest of us, so he got landing on some of the glaciers, and that helped promote it a bit, but it died out, too. There wasn't enough money in gold to keep it up.
Bush pilot Bob Reeve first saw Alaska in 1921, when a plane he was flying was forced down on the way from the Orient. With a long background of flying in the United States and in South America, Reeve came to Alaska to stay in 1932.
In those days, Alaska was standing still. Our main economy up here was gold mining and fishing and fur.
Reeve first settled in Valdez on the southern coast. It was while flying from this location that his exploits became a legend.
When I moved to Valdez, which used to be an old transportation town and mining town, it really at the low ebb. Well, to make a long story short, there were a lot of prospects around the mountains and the glaciers up there, and I made a specialty of flying up to these glaciers and mountains and landing prospectors and eventually mining equipment up there to mine them. And so I made my original start on snow and ice.
It was risky and it was daring. Reeve modified skis for his small Eagle Rock and Fairchild airplanes so that he could land on snow and ice in the mountains and then skim on those same skis across the tidal mud flats at Valdez. His methods of landing on slush and mud were unparalleled. Though many bush pilots perished in the hazardous flying of those days, most men walked away from the many forced landings or crashes with slow-flying planes.
Speed is what killed more pilots than anything else. You take a slow-landing Jenny or an airplane that landed 30, 40 miles an hour out in the swamp, and the pilot was outside in the cockpit where he can be thrown out or get out, and not trapped in a cabin, there were many, many of those incidents that happened, and for people were able to walk away. There's stories of pilots having a dozen forced landings in one trip. I remember I had five of them in 2 days once.
Among the true air pioneers who blazed air trails all over Alaska, some died at their work. Carl Ben Eielson, who came to Alaska in 1922 and died in a crash while on a rescue mission in Siberia in the winter of 1929-30. Russ Merrill, who pioneered air service in Anchorage. He died in September 1929 in a flight from Anchorage to the interior. His plane was never found. Ralph Wien, of the Flying Wien family, who died in a crash at Kotzebue in 1929. And Harold Gillam, who learned to fly in Fairbanks in the 1920s and amazed every other bush pilot with his daring ability to fly through any type of weather where no other man would go. Gillam died from injuries and exposure while walking out of the mountains after a crash near Ketchikan in January 1943. And, of course, there were others. The bush pilot brought a new era of transportation, replacing dog teams and river boats. Where the one railroad from Seward to Anchorage to Fairbanks left off, bush pilots picked up and spread out all over Alaska. Robert Atwood, editor of the Anchorage Times, explains.
It used to cost $1,500 and take 30 days to go from Anchorage to Nome by dog team. And when bush pilots came in with their little one-engine planes and no navigation aids, they could do it in two or three days, stopping overnight in different cities along the way. Of course, weather might delay them, but I guess they would with the dog team, too. So the airplane replaced the dog team first.
Communities developed along the rivers of Alaska where there was seasonal transportation by boat to the outside. Before airplanes came along, mail was hauled by riverboats. Atwood explains what eventually happened.
These bush pilots captured the mail contract by outbidding the riverboats. They could deliver it cheaper and faster. Well, these are the things that bush pilots did and started to build up the transportation pattern that exists today.
Many of the original bush pilots were awarded specific aviation routes when the National Civil Aviation Agency organized flying in the territory. Early flyers of the wilderness are today owners and managers of successful airlines, which crisscross the state and connect with the lower 48 to the south. Eskimos, Indians, the sourdough gold miner, bush pilots. Hardy and rugged people who form the backbone of Alaska. Their spirit is still alive in the 49th state as another age has begun. We'll tell you more about them in our next program.
Alaska, the last frontier. The second of four programs about the history, the people, the legend, and the promise of the colorful 49th state. Next week, a portrait in sound of the legends of Alaska. This program was written and narrated by Rhett Turner. Music was by Gene Dreyer. This is Jack Weitzel speaking for The Voice of America, Studio One.